Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Turkey's foreign minister, Mevlut, was barred from landing in the Netherlands as opposition grows to Turkish campaigning throughout the European Union. Ankara wants to drum up support among the millions of Turks living in Europe to give President Recep Tayyip Erdogan more powers, which could see him remain in office until the year 2029. Henry Ridgewell has the story.
Tensions have been building for several days as local authorities in Austria and Germany blocked appearances by Turkish ministers hoping to rally supporters in Europe. Turkey's foreign minister Mevlut Cavusoglu invited supporters into the grounds of its consulate in Hamburg on Tuesday after he was barred from using another building in the German city. Dutch far-right leader Geert Wilders waded into the debate this week ahead of a planned rally in The Hague.
We are in Holland here, not in Turkey, and a Turkish minister has no room here to lobby for somebody like Mr. Erdogan, who is a mere dictator.
Ankara blames what it calls growing fascism in Europe and has cast the rift as an attempt by Europe to influence the outcome of the April 16th referendum. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The U.S. House Intelligence Committee is calling on President Donald Trump to produce evidence by Monday that the phones at Trump Tower were wiretapped during the presidential campaign. President went on a Twitter rant a week ago saying former President Barack Obama had Trump Towers tapped. Trump did not offer any evidence. Committee Chairman Devin Nunes, a Republican from California, and Adam Schiff both sent a letter requesting the evidence. This is VOA News. U.S.-backed Iraqi forces are pushing deeper into western Mosul today to take positions still held by Islamic State militants. Since the government's initial push into the western side of the city began February 19th, U.S. and Iraqi commanders have described fierce IS resistance as the extremist force seeks to hold its last significant urban area in Iraq. Iraqi forces retook the eastern part of the city earlier this year after an offensive began October 17th. Large numbers of civilians have fled the fighting. An intruder with a backpack who scaled the outer perimeter fence around the White House was arrested on the grounds of the president's official residence in Washington. Secret Service officers arrested the person without incident and identified him as a 26-year-old California resident. President Trump, who was not involved in the incident in any way, said the young man was a troubled person. That man arrested had no criminal record. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence has appealed to voters in the state of Kentucky to support a battle in Congress to replace the nation's health care law, sometimes called Obamacare. The bill being pushed by Republican leaders. President Trump, Vice President Pence, and Republican Party leaders are facing opposition from both sides of the political spectrum as they try to promote their replacement for the health insurance law, which has been in operation since 2010. One of the major components, obtaining insurance even with pre-existing conditions, was addressed by Pence.
Make sure that Americans with pre-existing conditions still have access to the coverage and the care that they need. And to all the parents here, we'll make sure you can keep your kids on your plan until they're 26 years of age. And most significantly, in my view, we'll give states like Kentucky the freedom and flexibility with Medicaid to meet the needs of your most vulnerable in the way that works.
The United Nations says it needs $4.4 billion by July to prevent famine in Yemen, Somalia, northeastern Nigeria, and South Sudan. The UN says some of the people facing starvation are dying, while another 1 million are on the brink of famine. The World Food Program has been airdropping food and other assistance into South Sudan. The son of boxing champion Muhammad Ali has been detained and questioned at Washington's Ronald Reagan National Airport. A lawyer for Muhammad Ali Jr. speculates the detention was a retaliation for his client's appearance earlier in the day before U.S. lawmakers. They wanted to know about the February detention of Ali Jr. and his mother at a Florida airport where they were asked if they were Muslim. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We're in the state that we're defending ourselves. The call for the national dialogue, we welcome it. But there's a lot of measures that should be recommended.
South Sudanese President Salva Kiir calls on former Affairs Vice President Dr. Riek Machar to denounce violence.
The president really warned the people, the unscrupulous and treacherous health workers who were charging medical services and medical attention to people when they're supposed to be free.
Malawian President Atapita Mutharika is outraged after public health workers demand fees at government hospitals before treating patients.
Darren Kombo was on the floor of the house delivering a point of order. That was when the minister in the office of the president started interjecting with unpalatable language, language that is unparliamentary.
And insults in the Zambian parliament lead to a dispute that nearly led to blows. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. South Sudanese President Salva Kiir says his former Affairs Vice President Dr. Riek Machar can only participate in the national dialogue when he denounces violence. The president's remark follows his decision to pardon opponents, some of whom are in detention. Kiir also says some contentious issues in the peace accord he signed with Machar have been overcome because of what he calls the good working relations he has with the current Affairs Vice President Thabang Dengai. For reaction, I report Bod Paluang, the Director of Information and Public Relations of the SPLMIO.
We want to clear that. The government, they are the one who started launching offensive based on the July attacks in the J1, not us. So we're in the state that we're defending ourselves. The call for the national dialogue, we welcome it, but there's a lot of measures that should be recommended so that we can get inside to be part of the national dialogue. First of all, the war needs to stop because till now, yesterday, the government has an attacked a town of Mayendit after a day of calling the national prayer. And to us, that's been a hypocrisy.
You are aware that President Salva Kiir has been pardoning some opponents to be part of it. He says that members of the SPLMIO are violent, including the leader, and that renouncing the violence basically grants you the opportunity to join the national dialogue if indeed the SPLMIO cares for the people of South Sudan.
Yeah, that's his saying. But to be part of that national dialogue, that's a lot of things that need to be implemented first. We're not the first group or the first party just to launch that attack. The government, they used to attack us all the time. So first of all, we need to clear a ceasefire or the war to stop. Then we create a safe environment, okay, for the people so that the dialogue should be inclusive.
If you care for your people as the SPLMIO has been suggesting, why yes. wouldn't you do everything in your power to make peace with the president to be part of an...
We're doing what we have.
Which is what? Which is what?
But as you know, we're not only part in this crisis. The government, they're part of it. So even us, if we call for peace, ourselves and the government, they are not okay with that. Peace won't come to South Sudan.
So what do you think is the best step forward yes. to resolve this? Because the president has laid down what he would accept to make sure you join the national dialogue to resolve the political and the security crisis, unify the country so South Sudanese can return to the country and then begin working on attaining prosperity, among other things, because tens of thousands of them face famine at the moment.
To be part of this national dialogue, okay, we say that there's a need of the war to stop because the government, they are the ones who are starting all this war since July. Us, as an SPLMIO, we are pro-peace. And for the biggest example for that we're the first party to sign the peace agreement in August 2015. That's part of us to assure that the peace landing is in South Sudan. But the government, they are the part who violated all of it. For us to be part of the national dialogue, we said that the war should stop. And then to create an environment and a safe environment that for the national dialogue to be inclusive. Then that's the reason that this national dialogue should be conducted by a neutral mechanism, not the government itself, and should be conducted in a neutral ground, not in Juba. If we go to Juba, like you'll be like we're walking into a slaughter.
The president said obstacles within the peace agreement that you signed with him have been overcome because of the close, good working relations with Thabang Dengai, who was a former member of the SPLM-IO in opposition. How do you resolve this?
To us, to come back to implement the peace agreement, we need to go back and implement the peace agreement as it was signed, or to create a new initiative equivalent to the IARS that was signed in August 2015. For us, that the government should implement the exact articles of that peace agreement, or we need to adopt a new initiative. This is the only solution.
Pok Bod Paluang is the Director of Information and Public Relations of the SPLM-IO. He spoke with me from an undisclosed location in neighboring Sudan. Meanwhile, internally displaced persons or IDPs at the UN Protections of Civilian Site in the South Sudanese capital Juba staged a peaceful protest against President Kiir's national dialogue. They say they boycotted a national prayer day because they are being shut out of the dialogue process. For VOA, Tito Justin has more from Juba.
Hundreds of IDPs at UN Protection of Civilian Site 3 in Juba chant "No, no" for national prayers. They say they do not recognize the National Prayer Day because they don't believe the national dialogue expected to begin in few days is genuine. James Mabor is one of today's protesters.
We are not convinced that the national dialogue that Kiir is putting up is genuine and would help us out of the crisis. So we are saying it is meaningless. Number two, the prayers that he has put up has no relevance because usually the prayers are conducted by the church. As displaced persons, we are stakeholders in peace, but we think what he is doing now is not going to bring us any peace.
Mabor says today's prayers will not address the grievances of the people affected by the more than three-year-long conflict as long as there is no commitment from the government and armed oppositions to end the suffering across the country.
For this reason, we are demonstrating to the whole world and to Kiir himself that the move he is taking is not bailing the country out of the crisis, and he should not fool anybody about that. If he is serious about peace, which is primary and it should be number one, let him adhere to the agreement that was arrived at in Addis Ababa in August 2015.
Stephen Lohr, an elderly IDP taking part in today's protest, says he sees no reason to participate in the national prayers because he says IDPs like himself have been neglected by the government since the outbreak of violence in late 2013.
First of all, the prayer comes after degree of national dialogue. It's a national day for prayer. How can you pray for the dialogue that is not inclusive? Are we going to pray for such a peace so that God has to forgive him? Or what are we going to pray for?
Dola John, another IDP, says she did not participate in today's national dialogue because she still feels it is too dangerous to step outside the UN camp in Juba. Speaking in Arabic, she says the government should focus foremost on achieving lasting peace.
What they should do to bring peace is to realize that peace cannot be achieved by just only a part of the problem. They need to bring in even Riek Machar as well.
Akol Paul Kordit, South Sudan's Deputy Information Minister, insists that the National Prayer Day and dialogue are open to everybody in the country, including IDPs.
So for anybody now to conclude that they've been excluded or they have not been involved in the process, like our dear people in the IDP camps, I think that would be premature conclusion because the dialogue itself has not yet commenced. So how do you come to conclusion that you have been excluded?
Yesterday, government spokesman Michael Makwe said the armed opposition opposition and people living in rebel-held areas should first renounce rebellion before participating in the national dialogue. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
Malawian President Arthur Peter Mutharika expressed outrage after receiving reports that public health workers at government hospitals have been demanding money from patients in exchange for treatment. He warned that he would not only arrest them but also get them fired. The reports say patients have died due to delayed treatment because they could not afford to pay for the hospital fees for prompt and swift treatment. The president says his priority is to make healthcare delivery a great success in the country. To learn more, I reached Malawian Information Minister Nicholas Dawusi in the capital, Lilongwe.
Well, the president really warned the people, the unscrupulous and treacherous health workers who were charging medical services and medical attention to people when they're supposed to be free. And he warned that anybody found doing that malpractice will be dismissed there and then.
The president has said that he is going to make healthcare a great success story in the country. Are there any policies that the president has outlined that will make this a reality?
Yes, in fact, there is now a reform program going on in the health sector. For example, the provision of cancer treatment inside the country by the introduction and construction of ultra-modern cancer centre, and also the intake for training of doctors in specialised medical fields, and the making sure that the decentralisation of the health sector through the district assembly and district council. These are some of the initiatives that are taking place.
Critics of the president are saying that the charging of fees at hospitals, including Kamuzu Central Hospital, is a failure of the government policy and, by extension, the president's commitment to improve the health conditions of Malawians. What do you say to that?
As you have rightly said, that those are critics. They may not be fair comments. They can only be mere tantrums or mere speculation that have no basis whatsoever. The truth remains that, in fact, right now, we have kept the charging because those that were found were prosecuted. So there's nothing of failure whatsoever. But in any institutional services, there are some lapses and challenges which have to be faced head on. And that's what the president has promised. And we will definitely stop that.
He has promised to have an air balance for emergency cases. When will Malawians see this in fruition?
In fact, we will, with the help of our cooperating partners, there will be a construction of a military hospital with a general. All these are initiatives that are in the pipeline. And in due course, we will be announcing when and where, what time it will come to fruition.
Critics said the bucks should stop with the president and that the president should bear the blame for those people who are charging the fees because the state hospitals are not properly equipped. They don't have the medication that they need, and that the charging of the fees were meant to supplement efforts by the hospitals to take care of patients, and that the government has to do more than what it's doing. Your take?
The government will do what it can, and that's what we have said. In fact, in any developing country, it's a process. There is nowhere in the world when everything will be black and white overnight. I think we are trying all we can to make sure that the provision of medicine is up to standard, and equipment and other health paraphernalia are there so that people should be treated with a respect they deserve.
Nicholas Dawusi is the Malawian Information Minister. He spoke with me from Lilongwe. Zambian civil society groups are expressing concern following reports that a lawmaker threatened to beat up his colleague outside parliament. This after Mazabuka Central Member of Parliament Gary Nkombo challenged Kabwe Central Member of Parliament Tutua Ngulube to a physical fight outside Parliament, threatening to beat him up over insults during a parliamentary debate. For more on the latest political situation, I reach Richard Mulonga, an independent multimedia journalist in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
Gary Nkombo was on the floor of the House delivering a point of order. That was when the minister in the office of the president started interjecting with unpalatable language, language that is unparliamentary. This prompted Gary Nkombo to raise a point of order to seek the indulgence of the speaker. But Tutua Ngulube also started interjecting and involving himself in unparliamentary language and parliamentary conduct. This is when Gary Nkombo was agitated and he called for a fight outside the House.
This is not the first time that parliamentarians in the Zambian parliament have actually fought, is it?
No, not at all. If you remember in the late 1990s, late former president Michael Sata, when he was a member of parliament, was once clobbered by another member of parliament from Pongwe called Dawson Lupunga. And it was not pleasant because it almost resulted into a free punch-up for all in the House. But again, you remember recently when our members of parliament were voting for the new constitution of Zambia, there was almost another free punch-up for all where even the current minister of agriculture, Doris Elia, but that time she was an MMD parliamentarian for Petaoke Central. She ended up raising the middle finger at the Speaker of the House. So such things in the Zambian parliament are not quite exclusive because there are times when the tempers fly high and members of parliament do really resort to blows.
Some Zambians that I spoke with are saying that both Mazabuka Central Member of Parliament Gary Nkombo and Kabwe Central Member of Parliament Tutua Ngulube have to apologize unreservedly to the people of Zambia as well as to Parliament. And they urge Parliament to come up with strict ethical rules that will prevent such from happening.
Our Parliament has got enough regulations and rules that conduct the behavior of members of Parliament in that House. The problem has been the impartiality or the conduct of the Speaker. In the case that we are discussing, the Speaker has reserved the ruling on the conduct of the minister in the office of the president, Honorable Sikazwe. So the speaker is actually on the spot now because everything, the buck will end at him because he has to, you know, deliver a ruling that is impartial. But in the past, the conduct of the speaker has again added fuel to such discussions because the speaker would be viewed not to be impartial because they would rule under very controversial circumstances. They would deliver rulings that raise a lot of eyebrows. Zambians expect the speaker to be impartial in his conduct because he's not only representing the views of members of parliament that are coming from the ruling party, but he actually is representing each and every member of parliament in that house. And at the end of it all, the speaker is representing the views and the interests of the people of Zambia.
I understand the controversy surrounding President Edgar Lungu's decision to possibly run for re-election is generating a lot of steam in the country, with the Law Association of Zambia writing to the Constitutional Court, seeking the Constitutional Court to throw away the case that is challenging his eligibility at the Constitutional Court. What can you tell me about this?
This matter has generated a lot of interest among political players, among the legal minds, in the media here, and even citizens, because it has a lot of consequences on all these interest groups. President Edgar Lungu was elected initially on the old constitution, and then now he's operating on the new constitution that he assented to himself in the year 2015. So the eligibility of him to contest the 2021 election is based on the two constitutions. And it has taken some people to ask the Law Association of Zambia to come on board and offer some kind of legal guidance, because as ordinary citizens, we may not be experts to analyze the legal technicalities and all the jargon that is involved. When the Law Association of Zambia is trying to perform its role of giving legal guidance and offering these checks and balances legally, it has also come under a lot of fire, especially from the ruling party. If you remember last week, some youths went to attack the president of the Law Association of Zambia, accusing her of not being impartial and independent.
Richard Mulonga is a Zambian independent multimedia journalist. He spoke with me from Lusaka. Meanwhile, South Africa's most popular sports, namely soccer, rugby and cricket, have had women's teams competing internationally for a long time. But now there's a new, unexpected game attracting women from townships around the country's biggest city, Johannesburg, Ireland's national sport, Gaelic football. It's often described as a mixture of rugby and soccer. Players hit the ball to one another with their hands and then try to score goals by kicking the sphere either under or into a net or over H-shaped posts. For VOA, Darren Taylor has the story from Johannesburg.
Kick it in. It's going to drop a little short, but it's dangerously in there. And a goal!
South Africa's Gaelic footballers study the game by watching TV footage of big matches in Ireland. Competitors use their hands and feet to pass the round ball in the air or on the ground to teammates to get close to the opponent's H-shaped posts. Two teams of 15 players each try to score the most points by kicking the ball into the goal net, soccer style, or over the poles like in rugby.
Yeah, in Ireland, I guess it's a very historical game. It goes back through the centuries and people take great pride in the local teams. Then on top of that, it's quite an exciting game. It's a running game, high scoring. It's got some.
Keith O'Leary, a power plant developer, also coaches South Africa's national Gaelic football team, the SA Gaels. He's supported by fellow Irish expat, computer technologist and team chairman, David Devine.
Gaelic football globally has been Irish expats emigrating, bringing the game with them, having a kick around on a Friday night and going to the pub afterwards. That's been the tradition over the last couple of decades.
But now, Irish men like him and optician and team promoter Derek McCarthy are attracting South Africans to the sport.
We want the locals playing it. We want them absorbing the Irish culture and absorbing the love for the game, which they have been doing. And we started from such a small base, but it is really growing legs, and social media is just a great place to do that.
Hey! Go, 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 go!
A trainer drills the SA Gaels at a recent practice.
When the people who come to play for the first, second, third training session realize how easy it is for them to learn the skills, they then start promoting the game on our behalf. They go to their friends, who go to their friends, who go to their friends, and it becomes a bigger circle.
My background, I play soccer, but...
Tabiso Pakedi is part of that circle. He explains that Gaelic football is very fast and the training's tough. Pakedi says the different skills demanded by Gaelic football, like dribbling, hitting the ball and jumping high in the air to grab it, are what persuaded him to play it.
It's physical and handball, kicking, most kicking points, that's the most thing that I love, especially to make the team to win.
The athletic man in his mid-20s captains the SA Gaels. Coach O'Leary says it's difficult for them at this point as there's no Gaelic Football League in South Africa. So the squad trains in Johannesburg and plays proper matches in the Middle East, where Irish expats have entrenched the sport. The Gaels also visit Ireland as often as possible to learn from the masters. Pakedi recalls his first visit to the Emerald Isle.
Actually, I didn't know what to expect. The situation that we had there, it was the weather. The weather wasn't too good for us as we used to hot condition here.
But Irish coaches are surprised at the high-tempo game played by the South Africans, even on Ireland's storm-lashed, waterlogged, muddy fields. On the Gaels' visits to Ireland, O'Leary says eyes are on them before they touch a ball. He says the Irish are amazed to see black Africans in yellow, red, green and blue jerseys attempting their national sport.
The Irish are very attracted to the team because of the colour and the noise that they bring.
In Ireland, the South Africans pull off the odd victory, but usually lose. Yet even so, they celebrate because they always go down fighting. Devine says for people so new to Gaelic football, they're extremely talented.
I think the players now that we have are some of the best ambassadors that South Africa has from a sporting perspective that travel the world, promoting the game from a South African perspective and just spreading the word to show that they're well capable of taking on some of the best international teams in the world and some of the best club teams at home in Ireland.
Smiling, Pakedi describes his vision of the future of Gaelic football in his country as modest.
hopefully to see most of South Africans go to Ireland and compete against Irish and then to be the best, as if they are the one who have been playing the game before than the Irish.
Being virtually invisible in soccer-mad South Africa isn't dampening the enthusiasm of players like Pakedi. Instead, it's inspiring them to spread Gaelic football across the country and continent. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. And good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The African Champions League holders, Mamelodi Sundowns, began the defense of their crown with a 2-1 win over Kampala Capital City Authority, KCCA of Uganda, on Friday, but conceded what could be a vital away goal. South Africa's Sundowns hosted the first leg in Pretoria, as the top-ranked clubs entered the competition at the last 32 stage. The hosts set off to a blistering start, going 2-0 up inside the first 6 minutes before KCCA pulled one back in the second half. This stage of the Champions League also sees the four most successful clubs in African competitions enter the fray. Record 19-time title winners Al Ahly of Egypt face South Africa's league leaders Wits, who are playing in the elite African competition for the first time. TP Mazembe of the DR Congo, second behind Ahle with 10 successes, meet an impressive preliminary round winners, Cups United of Zimbabwe. Zamalek of Egypt, winners of 9 continental competitions and 2016 Champions League runners-up, Tako Enugu Rangers of Nigeria. Etoile du Sahel of Tunisia, the only club to win all 5 current and past Confederation of African Football competitions, also boasts 9 titles, ahead of a clash with AS Tanda of the Ivory Coast. There are a total of 8 past Champions League winners in the round. Esperance of Tunisia, Vita Club of DR Congo, and Wydad Casablanca of Morocco are some of the clubs who lifted the richest and most prized African trophy. Another 5 challengers, Leopards of Congo Brazzaville, FUS Rabat of Morocco, Oroya of Guinea, El Merrikh of Sudan, and Enugu have won other CAF titles. Meanwhile, Senegal hosts Zambia in Sunday's final of the Under-20 Africa Cup of Nations after beating Guinea 1-0 in Thursday's semi-final. The Senegalese took an early lead in Indola as Aliou Baji struck after 12 minutes. In first half stoppage time, Ibrahima Niana had the chance to double Senegal's lead, but his penalty was saved by Moussa Camara. Senegal has reached the final for the second tournament running. They contested the final for the first time in 2015, but were beaten by Nigeria. Neither Senegal nor Zambia, who beat South Africa 1-0 on Wednesday, have ever won the tournament before. Sunday's final is at the Heroes National Stadium in the capital, Lusaka. Moving on to athletics, the head of World Athletics, Sir Sebastian Coe, will visit Uganda. The International Association of Athletics Federation, IAAF boss, will be in Uganda to preside over the World Cross Country Championship. Coe will lead what the local organizing committee of the March 26th event has described as a big IAAF delegation. He will also preside over Kampala's handover to Aarhus. The Danish city also hosts of the 2014 World Half Marathon, unanimously won the bid to stage the next World Cross Country in 2019. Coe headed the successful London bid to host the 2012 Summer Olympics and became chairman of the London Organizing Committee for the Olympic Games. He was elected a vice president of the IAAF in 2007 and was re-elected for another four-year term in 2011. And in August 2015, he was elected president of IAAF. In basketball, the 2017 FIBA Africa Zone 5 Championship begin on Sunday in Cairo, Egypt. 9 countries are expected to compete in the championship that runs until March 18th. This Zone 5 tournament include Uganda, Kenya, Burundi, Ethiopia, Somalia, South Sudan, and Tanzania. Finally, a knee injury has forced world number one Serena Williams to pull out of the BNP Paribas Open at Indian Wells. The 35-year Williams is also to miss the Miami Open later this month. Williams, who won an Open era record 23 Grand Slam at the Australian Open earlier this year, is reported to have said she has not been able to train due to her knees but promised to return soon. Williams' withdrawal means German's Angelika Kerber is set to replace her as world number one. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Chant, yeah. Chant, yeah. my sense to the Ghana, the property say, no time, like a statue of liberty. Nobody knows tomorrow, so I'll be holding my destiny, yeah. As if he say, I don't go, some people they bubble, I continue the struggle, the struggle they double my hustle, as if he say, I don't go, some people they bubble, I continue the struggle, they double my hustle, yeah. Now I'm giving my testimony. Je m'appelle Chop Money. Hey, it's good to be saving for rainy days. Not so, cause you know easy, yeah. Life is so delicate. Oh, oh, so make una see me as evidence. Papa God, now my confidence. Yes, his blessings are endless. So, hey. As if he said, I don't go. Some people they bubble, hey. I continue the struggle, the struggle they double my hustle, hey. As if he said, I don't go. Some people they bubble, hey. I continue the struggle, they double my hustle, yeah. Now I'm giving my testimony. Belle job money. As if he said, I don't go. Some people they bubble, hey. I continue the struggle, the struggle they double my hustle, hey. As if he said, I don't go. Some people they bubble, hey. I continue the struggle, they double my hustle, yeah. Now I'm giving my testimony.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. How arrogant could those who control the International Criminal Court and The Hague be? Or is this just a matter of divide and dominate? Last week, it was reported that the ICC in The Hague had summoned the government of South Africa to appear before the court on the 7th of April to review whether or not the government of South Africa breached its commitment under the Rome Statute when it failed to arrest Omar Bashir, the president of the Sudan, on the orders of the ICC. Bear in mind that the High Court in South Africa had already discussed the matter and found that the government had breached its commitment under the South African Constitution. Why is it that the ICC is now taking this action? You must recall, and regrettably so, that the issue of the ICC is now embroiled in the local political struggle between the ANC and the main opposition party, with a very strong pro-ICC NGO in South Africa. The main opposition party had used the ICC as a cudgel to fight the ANC. It was the opposition party that took the government to court when Bashir was not arrested in 2015. And because of the criticism of the ICC, the government of South Africa decided it would withdraw from the ICC. Already, it submitted its notification to the Secretary General of the United Nations. And remember also, it was the opposition party in South Africa that took the ANC to court for not going through Parliament. It got a favorable decision from the High Court, and then the ANC decided that on the basis of the technical decision of the court, it revoked its notification and planned to go through the parliamentary procedure. Again, it was the opposition party that has pledged to fight the government in any attempt to withdraw from the ICC. Just 2 days ago, a major legal scholar associated with the opposition pledged to fight and fight and fight for the ICC. It is in this toxic situation that the ICC has become emboldened and want to flex its muscle, and it's calling for the government to appear before it on the 7th of April. The ICC may also be sending a message to both the African Union and African governments. You may recall that at the last summit of the African Union, it was decided and recommended to governments to withdraw en masse from the ICC. You must also recall that the African Union had called on governments not to cooperate with the ICC. Also last week, the new government of the Gambia, Adama Barrow, has revoked the decision of the former government of Yahya Jammeh to withdraw from the ICC. What we have now is the ICC telling the African Union and African government, if you move against us, we have the means and the strength to oppose you. The warning to all Africans is this: owing to the in the continent and the penchant for dependency, it is becoming increasingly clear that the exercise of African sovereignty is in jeopardy. The ICC is telling you that this is the case. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, it is the things that the elders had seen that pushed their eyes into the sockets. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
North Korea is an authoritarian state led by the Kim family for more than 60 years. According to the newly released annual State Department Human Rights Report, human rights conditions in North Korea remain abysmal. The government subjects citizens to rigid controls over many aspects of their lives, including denial of the freedoms of speech, press, assembly, association, religion, movement, and worker rights. The government operates a network of political prison camps in which conditions are often harsh, life-threatening, and include forced and compulsory labor. According to the 2015 Korea Institute for National Unification white paper, the Ministry of State Security administered prison camps or Kwanli-so camps. There are reportedly between 5,000 and 50,000 prisoners in each of the five Kwanli-so. Reports indicated that conditions in the prison camp and detention system were harsh and life-threatening, and that systematic and severe human rights abuse occurred. Detainees and prisoners consistently reported violence and torture, and defectors described witnessing public executions in political prison camps. Numerous defector accounts and non-governmental organization reports describe the use of torture by authorities in several detention facilities. Methods of torture and other abuse reportedly included severe beatings, electric shock, prolonged periods of exposure to the elements, humiliations such as public nakedness, confinement for up to several weeks in small punishment cells in which prisoners were unable to stand upright or lie down, among others. Mothers were in some cases reportedly forced to watch the infanticide of their newborn children. Defectors continue to report many prisoners died from torture, disease, starvation, exposure to the elements, or a combination of these causes. The 2016 White Paper on Human Rights in North Korea, published by the Korea Institute for National Unification, and the 2014 UN Commission of Inquiry report stated that officials had in some cases prohibited live births in prison and ordered forced abortions as recently as 2013. Promoting human rights and democratic governance is a core element of U.S. foreign policy, said U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. These human rights reports, he said, demonstrate the United States' unwavering commitment to advancing liberty, human dignity, and global prosperity, including in North Korea.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.